Perhaps you could move the circle a little bit this way? Don't want to crowd up too much because I presume more people coming in. A little more intimacy with the kids. Oh boy. If Michael's sitting on the left side of the room, this could be a whole different experience. All right, everybody. Is this our second to last class? Wow. So I'd like to begin, as we always do, with your questions, comments, issues from the study group this morning. Things you're working on from your papers that might require some clarification. What was that question again?
I have a question. Do you want to say anything from the study group? All right. Well, this isn't from the study group. This is just something that I've been kind of thinking about in my paper. And the basic question is, like, where do expired actual locations go? Uh-huh. So the past matter,
right,
all around us, where do they go?
Right.
When I'm thinking about it, it seems like they might stay near where they occurred in space and time. So that, like, my body is made up of all these expired actual locations that just kind of hover around me and kind of, like, to me it kind of seems like the energy field, because when you prehend someone, you're getting the energy of all their past. So just in kind of thinking about what is the energy field, how are you prehending the energy from people, I came up with that question.
Right.
Where do the expired occasions go? Are they not even in space and time anymore?
Right, interesting question, but let me ask you another question. What's energy?
Well, it's the transmission of experience.
Okay, that's what you mean, okay.
So if you have all these expired occasions, you can prehend them and relive them, and that's the energy coming
right
from the past into you.
Right, now, so this was an interesting question. Where are they? And, by the way, Christensen wrote an introductory text to Whitehead that I read a while ago. He comes up with the same question. And so he decides that the actual occasions must continue to endure in the consequent nature of God. So that's one possible solution. Whitehead himself seems to say that the actual occasions endure as the characteristic of creativity. In other words, creativity itself is altered by that which it creates. And so it begins, and just as each moment of creativity emerges out of the past, right? It's like creativity has taken on the character that it gave itself in past conscious experience. So those are two possible answers, right? But it is an interesting question because, remember, the final answer probably has to be, or at least one of the answers has to be, that the expired actual occasions continue to exist in the experience of future actual occasions. And that answer might be sufficient. And it might be that certain habits of thought lead us to think we need to find someplace else for it.
Could you say that part just one more time?
In the experience of future occasions. In other words, each one of us is an atom of space-time in which a universe exists. And that universe includes the entirety of its past. So my universe includes at least my past life cone and probably more, and so forth, right? And so we all exist in each other. Right? It's the creative advance that houses its own past in some way. Right? Now, but on the other hand, maybe that's not quite enough, because then there are these moments of transition. That is, one occasion ends and then another occasion starts. So where are the occasions during that gap, right? And so then, consequent nature of God or character of creativity emerge as possible answers. So what's really interesting is that I've discovered this in a lot of philosophical systems, is that you begin the system fairly close to experience. Otherwise it's boring and not very interesting, right? So you start with some kind of phenomenology. And this is certainly true with Whitehead, right? Where Whitehead investigates phenomenologically, he investigates experience. And he comes up with this unutterably brilliant idea of actual occasions. Now this comes out of experience, right? Now this is a new idea for explaining things. And so then he starts to ramify it. Well, what can I explain with it, right? Can I account for objects? Can I account for nexus? And can I account for space and time in this new way, right? So he sort of builds it up from the center of experience. And then at a certain point, you start to reach the outer edges of the system. And you start to ask questions like the questions that you're asking. The questions like, well, where are the actual occasions that they expire? And what is the nature of God? You notice this is also, for Whitehead, it's sort of an afterthought. His whole theology is almost like an afterthought, right? So what I notice is that we start close to experience, and we either move in the phenomenological direction or scientific direction, and we come up with explanations, and then in subsequent reflection, we begin to carry those explanations out toward their ultimate borders and begin to ask these deep metaphysical questions. And at that point, what's interesting is things become very fuzzy. The answers actually become a little bit less important in some way and a little more arbitrary, which is to say that as we get to the outer borders of the system, data becomes less relevant and values become more relevant. Right? So it's almost as if in the outer layers of the metaphysical system, it sort of bleeds off into the mythos. Right? So again, your question is one of those great questions that you come up with. It's a brilliant philosopher's question, right? And there are several people who tried to answer it in different ways, so you're right in the tradition asking that question. And all the answers are interesting, but in a certain way they're interesting, right? Because, like in everything else we're talking about, it hardly matters, the answer to that question. Even though it's interesting and important. I'm not saying it's not, but I just noticed, this is an interesting feature of philosophy, that at the very outer edges it sort of dissolves into mythos because the data at that point becomes completely inaccessible, except in the case of mystical experience, in which case some of these issues might be claimed to have some sort of empirical way of being validated.
But one of the features of that is that the location of the boundaries is dependent on the nature of the philosophical system.
Yeah.
So you might have a philosophical system that started with a question like that, maybe putting it in a different way because it wasn't Whiteheadian.
Right.
And that might be central to that.
Right.
And that might lead to all kinds of incredible philosophical speculation and useful stuff. But that would be because the aims of whoever set up that philosophical system were different. And so they might have things on their periphery that were central to Whitehead.
Absolutely.
So,
although that's true, and I agree with you, I do want to pull back one little strand of what I was saying, which is that if you start with a question like that, where are actuality?
Well, you know,
it's sort of like you can't really go very far, right? Like your philosophy really, I think, pragmatically has to start closer to home. In some way.
Yeah.
But still, what you're saying
but
is well
so you
taken.
Might start closer to home, but in an area that's closer to the answer to that kind of question.
Exactly.
Would be a better way to put
exactly.
It.
Yeah. So, I think I said it before, but I'm going to say it again, that whole little crisis I went through earlier this semester with Kassir has really changed, finally, my relationship to thinking. And what I realized is that earlier in my life, when I'd read all these books, I wanted to read the books to find out how things are. Like, I wanted to know, how do things really work? First, I thought the scientists knew, and then I discovered they didn't know, and then I thought maybe the philosophers knew, but they didn't know, right? And finally, through Kassir, I began to understand that human philosophical thought is a creative, artistic activity. Right? It's an interpretive activity. It's a way that we, as a linguistic community, construct a shared world of experience. Right. And so, even, I'm not saying philosophy is purely made up. I'm not making a deconstructionist move here. I think that the way in which we interpret reality is largely conditioned by the way reality is. It's a compromise between the way things are and our own aims, and we form an interpretation of the way things are based on our aims, ultimately, right? So our interpretations are arbitrary, but there's an arbitrary element in them, right? Because if we look at the world through different philosophical attitudes, we reveal a different shared reality. You see what I'm saying? Right? And so every system has its truths, every system has its particular areas of applicability, every system has the values that it supports. Right? And then within that, there's good reasoning and bad reasoning, which are also relevant. Right? But still, more or less, it's this question of values. And I lost the where I was going there. What was I talking about?
The stuff about how the scientists knew and then they didn't know.
All right, and so it's this idea of construction. It's the idea that what we're doing here in this class, I used to think in a class like this we were trying to discover the nature of reality. And now I think we're trying to construct a useful and humane interpretation of reality that we can use to live well. But in that sense, I become a bit of a pragmatist, right? It's like I start to think about my own thoughts, not as discoveries of what is, but as useful and elegant interpretations that are humanly relevant of what is.
Is that participatory?
Yes, very participatory. I think I'm moving here into Jorge's territory. And I should read his book, but I've discovered the radically participatory nature, I think, in Jorge's language, of our own reality construction. That is, human beings participate in the construction of a social reality, and that social reality has very deep and important relationships with the actual world. It's not irrelevant. I mean, scientific truth is validated by experiment insofar as we accept that criterion. I mean, it works. It produces this building, right? So we know it works. Now, I would say that the scientific structure of reality is based on interests and aims that are so narrow and so fundamentally, in Whitehead's sense, evil, that it leads to a very destructive way of life. But it doesn't mean it's wrong. It just means that it's constructed under very narrow values that become destructive to the greater good. Is that topic? Okay? Okay. Any other questions or comments that are coming up for you guys? Yeah?
We were looking at charts of different ideas of transphysical worlds, dimensions, frequencies, bodies, whatever.
Right.
And one thing that came up was there's a website that Madeline knew about that compares Steiner and Aurobindo.
Oh, really? You email me that link?
Yeah, I can put it up on the site.
Yeah, exactly. Site. I'm sure. Yeah.
But one question that was really interesting, I'm gonna back up a little bit. We were talking about the physical body and then, like, let's say the etheric or the astral body. And people talk about being able to see auras,
right,
that they visualize as representations of something that's happening in what we've been discussing as a different world.
Yeah.
And so is that a physical manifestation of something that's transphysical? So that's one question that came out of this. Do you have any thinking on that?
Well, it's a vexed area for me. The idea of the etheric body has been very fully developed by the theosophists. A.E. Powell, who synthesized all the theosophical literature, has a whole book on the etheric body, right? And they describe the etheric body as being the place where the chakras are, and they describe all the energy flows going through the etheric body, right? And the theosophists claim that the etheric body is actually part of the physical and not part of the transphysical, right? So they have this interesting scheme. I think there's material deserves study. I think there's a lot in there that we could draw from it. And particularly Alice Bailey has this scheme Okay, so it's a 7-level scheme that she's got, right? With the physical, the astral, the mental, and then what does she call them? The causal. And then she's got all these weird words, the buddhic, the atman, atmic, and all these other words for these higher three planes, right? But the idea is that there's the upper three and the lower four. Right, and the upper three are formless. They'd be sort of like, you know, overmind, supermind kind of levels in the theosophical system. This 3-4 distinction gets repeated on each level. So each one of these levels, like in the physical level, there are also 7 layers, right? And the upper three layers are the etheric. Right, so there's sort of an implication that on each plane, there's sort of a formless part and a formed part. So there's sort of a fractal model. And so they make the etheric the upper part of the physical. Right? And their fantasy seems to be like in the upper formless part, it's all sort of fluid. But then in the lower parts, it gets all sort of solid-y. Right? So these ideas are very crude that they have, but they're somehow provocative. And they may have something for us. And so they would say that the etheric perception is an ordinary part of physical perception that have been repressed under modern conditions. And this would, of course, this would fit with Gebser, who points out that all depictions of human beings coming from the magical era depict the aura. Right? And that drops out when you get into the mythic period. And the mouth appears instead. In the magical figures, there's an aura, but no mouth. And then when the mythic period comes along, mouths start to appear, right? So the implication is, number one, that the aura was visible naturally to people in those situations, which is not entirely implausible, because the people who see auras claim it's really easy. We've probably all seen what might be auras. You know, if you just look at somebody behind them, your visual field does weird stuff. And sometimes, kind of, every once in a while, I've seen like these really distinct colors coming off the people. But, you know, the lighting is always pretty strange, and I'm never entirely sure it's an optical illusion, right? But, you know, so, Red, was that guy Redfern wrote that book, The Celestine Prophecy? Interesting book, but there was one insight in that book that really turned me on. He said you can learn to see the etheric by appreciating beauty, right? And so the more you open to beauty, the more your etheric perception opens up. Right, so there's this whole idea of this sort of subtle part of the physical world that's sensorially accessible under the right conditions, and that seems to have all the organs and everything, you know, the chakras in it, right? And that seems to be a very important idea, and it's a big part of the theosophical literature, and I think that it's an idea that has a lot of medical relevance. Right? Because it seems like what they're claiming is that a lot of this, if the chakras are on the etheric level, then obviously the etheric level is the source of a lot of physical affliction, clearing up the etheric level, and so forth. Right? So, interesting. I'd love one of you to write a paper on that, because it's just a really interesting, rich literature. Right? Sri Aurobindo doesn't talk about that at all. He just doesn't mention it. Right? Instead, he mentions this, what I've been calling the subtle physical or the transphysical physical, which is totally different than the etheric, right? And so I finally decided just this moment that they're just completely different things, right? They're just not referring to the same thing. In other words, his subtle physical is not the etheric. And so the etheric is most probably a subtle portion of the physical world. It could even be, for example, electromagnetic or something like that, right? It's like, it would not be entirely implausible if we discovered that it was something like electromagnetic, that would kind of fit. Subtle physicals, got, you know, energy currents, and there might be some way of that these can self-organize. I don't exactly know, right? So it's for me, it's just one of those areas I haven't been able to really reach any clear conclusion on, and I'm welcoming research into that area.
There is one thing that comes to mind off of what you just said, which is that Robert O. Becker did a lot of research starting in the 60s about electromagnetic fields.
Right.
And he's the one who discovered that when a salamander loses its limb and is able to regenerate it, whereas a frog cannot, in the local area on the salamander's body, the DC field of the body has its polarity reversed in that particular location. So he tried to do that with the frog, and the frog could regenerate the limb.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And so you know, that might be a manifestation of that phenomenon.
That's right. So that to me would be a really promising avenue of research, is to try to account for the etheric phenomena in terms of physical science, using concepts like electromagnetic fields and so forth. So that might be possible, and I don't know how to do it, but it would be interesting to try. Yeah.
One other interesting researcher to mention in this regard is a guy named, I think it's Motoyama.
I was just thinking about it. Yeah.
And he designed this thing called the chakra machine.
Right.
As far as I know, it's the most advanced kind of research in terms of chakras and etheric energies. And,
right.
And he's found some really fascinating data.
Yeah.
People who have subjectively claimed, like, my heart chakra is awakened.
Right.
Or whatever. And he finds that the electromagnetic field that emanates from that area of the body is way stronger.
Right.
And then he does things like, okay, now focus on activating, you know, your heart chakra. And when you subjectively feel that it's been activated, push this button. And then they find, you know, very strong correlations between the changes and the frequency and intensity of that field. And then the cool thing about the medical research was that he's also did some studies where they looked at the health of the organ systems that were traditionally associated in the Hindu philosophy with each chakra. And he found really strong correlations between, you know, if that chakra is awakened and there's a strong frequency and intensity of electromagnetic energy emanating from that area of the body, then the organs associated with that chakra have lower disease rates.
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
So now this would be a marvelous PhD dissertation, right? There's research being done on the subject, right? And interesting research, scientific research, and this seems to be a place where the scientific research would be most likely to be relevant to some of the transphysical studies. And what would be interesting would be to go into this with a process sensitivity, right? So you wouldn't get involved in the whole mind-brain problem with the whole thing, right? Because you'd already see how it was intrinsically functioning in consciousness. And so to then bring together the process perspective, the scientific research, the ideas of electromagnetism, and the concept of the etheric body, that could be a really powerful dissertation and may possibly have big implications in the health field if it works out, right? So that would be a really fascinating thing to work on, really ripe for research.
So another question that came up, this kind of relates to the Alice Bradley thing. One of the diagrams... Alice Bailey,
Bailey,
sorry.
Thanks, sorry. That's right.
One of the diagrams showed the physical as having a... What was it? Physical?
Physical, vital, and mental at the physical...
level, right.
And then at the vital level, you also have physical...
That's kind of what he was talking about. Right?
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about here, because I was making seven.
It was three instead of seven.
Instead of a fractal three.
Okay.
Right, so it's the exact same idea.
Yeah.
The book, by the way, is... The book that's probably most relevant here from Alice Bailey is A Treatise on Cosmic Fire, which is an amazing book and has some of the most incredible insights in it. It was my introduction to the universe story, because the whole universe story is there in that book. So when I came here to CIS, I couldn't figure out why it was such a big deal. I read about it decades ago, you know, in Alice Bailey. But it's channeled, right? And it's very clear to me that there are passages that are of unutterable brilliance, and there are passages that are dreck and boring, and they go on for hundreds of pages sometimes, and you can't make heads or tails out of it. So I've given up on Alice Bailey because I haven't got the patience anymore. But I think she was not by no means a perfect channel. And I think the whole idea of representing the universe as sort of a fractal expansion of the British empire was a little much the influence of her personality there, right? But on the other hand, there's a lot of fascinating suggestions, incredible occult suggestions, brilliant moments that emerge out of this. If anybody's got the patience, you can check it out, right? But I no longer have the patience.
It's the most intense thing I've ever read.
Yeah.
It's like, it's totally crazy.
It's crazy.
It's like, I mean, I don't even get it, but it's...
I know, I remember reading through like 100 pages and just not getting what the central idea was, right? But then I remember other places, I read it more than once, I think, and it was just, I couldn't find anything else.
She also says there that according to whatever initiation level that individual is at who's reading it, it's like there's different layers of meaning that are, you're only supposed to be able to get it if you're a third degree initiate or something like that.
Yeah. And you know, on the one hand, this idea of things being self-secret has become very, very intelligible to me, because I've discovered that my work is self-secret. Like, you guys get it, no problem, because you're open and prepared. The guys at Esalen are secret to them. Built up their openness and their knowledge base to the point where they can find intelligible, right? So maybe Alice Bailey has depths and maybe Andre Lightbug go back and read and reread it, discover them all. But right now it doesn't seem like the most useful thing to read unless you've got a lot of time on your hands. But I think Irvin does so much better. Okay. But there is, like I said, there's material in there that needs to be mined. That also, what I do recommend, just partly for fun and partly for just fascinating suggestiveness, are all the books by A.E. Powell. The Etheric Body, the Astral Body, the Mental Body, the Causal Body, and the Solar System. There are five of them. And the fifth one's a little hard to get. But what he's done is he's gone through all the other theosophical writers and pulled out all the interesting things they had to say and organize them into a single narrative, which is very readable and quite fascinating and just very provocative. Old, out of date, metaphysically naive, but really provocative and interesting. So that's worth reading, I think, at least for fun. Okay. So we're discussing two chapters today, and chapter 10, I thought, did not add a great deal of new material. It seems to be more of a review and sort of a putting together of things. And I want to spend most of the time on chapter 11. But first of all, were there any questions from chapter 10 that you guys had? And then I'll make a few comments about it. I went to the frequency and here. I'm not really quite lecturing about that. I think I've come to lecture about it enough. But the diagram here in figure one, I want to see this clearly, this understanding. What page is it on for you guys? Since I have 11. Which is this abstract diagram of a human self, a human personality. And does this diagram make sense to you? Does it help you? You see some of the possibilities. You're all being very quiet, so I'm not sure what's going on. But briefly, if we talk about the physical world, the astral world, and the mental world, we have the inorganic molecules down here, and as we said, this is very abstract. These inorganic molecules are brought into cellular form by the presence of astral occasions. This is very, very simplified, right? And these astral occasions are then brought together into organs and so forth, right? And then all the organs, all the major organs and all the sense organs, all report in to this personally ordered society, which is not the personality, but is what the Buddhists call the sixth consciousness, the manas. And it is the perceptive function within us that perceives what all the other senses perceives and coordinates them into a whole picture of the world. And it's also the consciousness in us which translates our own intentions into form that the body can operate on. So I think of it as sort of the body's control panel. That's how I think of the sixth consciousness. And then also reporting to this sixth consciousness are all these other little personalities that I've been mentioning. For example, the idiot savant that knows how to catch a ball and other little various functions, semi-autonomous sub-functions.
Quick question about that.
Yeah.
The sub-personalities are operating on the mental level for you? Sub-personalities?
Yeah.
I was surprised to see that. Like, they're not also vital.
They're on all levels. And what I meant by sub-personalities was something specific. I didn't draw this exactly right. Let me draw this better. So, what I did here, is that, I can't draw. The diagram is there. Let's just look at the diagram, right? So there's the top circle, which is the self. The second circle is what I'm calling the sixth consciousness of the manas. And it's on the mental level, and all these various organ consciousness and sense consciousness all report to this sixth consciousness, right? And then there's a higher consciousness, a higher grade personally ordered society, which is actually our personality, me, right? I'm the one who gives controls, instructions to my body. I'm the one who receives the objectifications from my body's senses and so forth. But then it's kind of obvious to all of us that me is not as simple as it looks, right? That the idea of the unity of the personality is an arbitrary convenience and a high abstraction, because we all have personalities that are fluid and change. With big mood changes, we have them, and then if we're a little less integrated, we have multiple personality disorder and so forth. And all of us have functional autonomous sub-personalities that are operating in us. So, for example, everybody I know has a critic, right? And everybody's critic is different, right? It's an amazing experience if you can actually embody your critic and talk the way it talks, you know? And actually have a dialogue with it. I've done that with some of my clients. It's been astounding what it's like when people actually embody their own critic, right? And feel they feel how intense the pleasure the critic gets when it's criticizing and being mean, you know, it's really interesting. And so what I'm saying is that's a sub-autonomous sub-personality. I've got another one in me. I've got a little helper in me. Sort of, I can think of him as the general, right? And so like when I'm really ill or if I'm really confused, and he comes in, he says, okay, he says, all you gotta do is just find your shoes. That's all you gotta do. You just do that. Okay, we found them. Now, pick up one of them and open it up. So I got this little helper personality that comes in when I'm really out of it and sort of gets me through, right? And so we've all got these little semi-autonomous personalities, right? And we all know that they occasionally take over from us. Freudian slips is the classic example, right? But sometimes it can be really weird, you know? I mean, sometimes all of a sudden, especially like in intensely emotional situations, we will hear ourselves saying things that we really don't want to say, right? So it's like some other one of these personalities has taken control of the control panel and is operating the body and has sort of pushed us out of the center, right? So we have a personality that's sort of an habitual central personality, but really it's a question of more or less. We're sort of a cloud of personalities, right? And so the interesting part of this chapter for me is the recognition of the human being as a complex of functioning individual personalities. with their individual aims and individual processes, and so we're a community. We're a kind of a democracy, sort of a partial democracy, you know, sort of a feudal form of a feudalism, more of a feudal structure, or even a democratic structure in our bodies. And I think it would be possible to build a very, very interesting psychology based on this. And so one of the conclusions would be that in some sense, in some really interesting sense, the physical, not the physical body, the waking body is the personal unconscious. That is, the personal unconscious is the experience and the memory of all the organs and organ systems and sensory systems and so forth that's actually in the body. That's kind of interesting to think of it that way. And the whole way of looking at the personality as a complex. Right? So one of the things that psychology is most confused about, in my estimation, is the nature of the individual. Like if you read like psychoanalytic stuff, and this also somewhat applies to at least the early Almos literature, they speak as if the ego comes into being as a function of object relations, right? So in psychology, objects are things like the mother or the mother's breast or the father or whatever, right? And so they have this idea that the child perceives objects and then internalizes them and then builds up some model of itself as an object among objects. And they go on and on about this, right? Which is kind of interesting and maybe applicable in certain therapeutic ways. But they never ask the question, who is it who has object relations in the first place? Where is there a center of consciousness to do all this processing with objects? They simply leave that question out. And so they simply refuse to consider the important philosophical question, which is, where does consciousness come from and why is it individualized? Right? And you can't account for that psychoanalytically because all psychoanalytical accounts presume the existence of that. And this is why, at least with the early Almos stuff, I gave up on it, because he was acting as if this ego that had been formed through object relations, if you could somehow cure that, you would be cured of ego and therefore enlightened. But of course, that's not what the ego is. The ego is the preconditions of ignorance which enforce the necessity of constructing a persona. Right? And that's right, and so he's so what do you work? Just missed that point. So this theory actually accounts for the personality, for the center of consciousness, right? Because it gives every functional center of the body its own center of consciousness, which is part of an ontological theory, which goes back to God, which is consistent with physics, right? And so now you've got a psychology that's totally consistent with quantum physics and which is also really illuminating a lot of the issues that psychotherapists are actually working with. So I think there's another dissertation to be written, which would just be a whole process psychology. Some people have done some work on it. There have a couple of books on it. They're really poor, and they don't take into account the transphysical dimension, and so that's another dissertation that would just be great. Okay, any questions about that basic idea? Yeah?
I'm curious, so then the shadow, is that considered a sub-personality?
Yeah. In fact, what I was sort of suggesting here was that we have two groups of sub-personalities. One that's sort of the in crowd, and one that's sort of the out crowd, right? And the out crowd is the shadow, right? Those are the sub personalities that the dominant part of us doesn't like, and it disrupts their unity. So in a certain sense, our dominant personality is a clique, and the outside ones are the shadow.
So each organ in society of actual occasions contribute a particular personality to the cloud?
Yes. For example, I mean, they used to know about this a lot. This also goes along with Montanami's research. They knew that the liver had cholera, choleric, and it made you angry. Right?
Yeah.
And we all, you know, and the throat, we all know, brings sadness, right? And this area brings sexual lust, right? And so the idea is that each organ consciousness filters the world through its own set of values and contributes the interpretation through those values to the dominant personality.
I did a liver cleanse once and I was really angry for several weeks.
Exactly. Right. So we can see these connections, and the ancient peoples knew a lot about them. We sort of...
That would be the somatics. That would be about, you know, I mean, a lot of our language comes from parts of the body,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Now, the word choleric used to mean angry, and it's because...
But it's not just so the each physical so there's a physical contribution to the personality, and then there's these transphysical contributions to the personality.
That's right. And the liver, for example, has its own liver consciousness, and so it's actually making a transphysical contribution to my transphysical personality, right? It's part of what it's a dominant influence on my mood, my various organs. Are dominant influences on my moods. Your organs are secondary influences on my moods, directly through that vital world, right? Yeah.
So the organ consciousness is able to prehend other occasions.
They prehend the whole. Each one of them prehends the whole world. Number one, the whole world, just like we do. Secondly. Each one of the organ consciousnesses in our body is in intimate communion with all the other organ consciousnesses, as are our sense consciousnesses, in intimate relationship with each other. Right? And so by the time we put it all together, there's been a tremendous amount of this intercommunication among all the different personalities constituting ourself. Right? So there's an incredible process involved. All these different values. Now, fortunately, all the personalities in our body are formed under the influence of the aim of the generally dominant occasions, and so there's a strong tendency for them to know each other well, to know each other so well that they feel each other's pain, so they're inspired to cooperate with each other, right? And so the body works as a unity, right? But it is nonetheless a society of occasions, each one of which has its own ultimate relationship with the divine and its own ultimate quantum of freedom. Right? And so our every cell in our body is making spontaneous decisions. And if it weren't for the fact that somehow their aims were coordinated, our bodies would disintegrate. Right? Yes?
Getting back to your earlier point, and I don't know if you touched upon this at all, but I'm just interested in your thoughts, and I think it's not outside the scope that we were assigned reading for in Rick's last class. James Hillman,
yes.
And his ideas about, it seems like there may be some overlap. I'm just kind of getting exposure to it, to some of what you're talking about in terms of a more inclusive, quantum-esque perception of personality and not so kind of, object it was.
Right. I studied Hillman fairly intensively for a few years back in the 70s. I read Revisioning Personality 3 times. It's one of the only books I ever read 3 times. I still don't understand it, but I was fascinated anyway. And my sense is that Hillman is up to something very different from what I'm up to. I think, I don't feel authoritative as many years, but my impression is that Hillman, I think he and I would like each other, but he's interested in breaking down some of the dominant ideas, but he has this idea of the unconscious as a realm of image, and he sticks with that. As far as I know, and I don't know his later work or anything, but as far as I know, he never ontologizes it. It's all a world of image for him, and he's very polytheistic. And he tends to, he loves to be polemical, and he loves to fight. He plays that way, right? And so he's adopted this radically anti-monotheistic stand. And he's not wrong. I mean, it's fun, right? I'm kind of a monotheist, and so I sort of think he's a little one-sided, right? But my general impression is that he's really a psychologist and not a philosopher. And so I resonate with him, but I have not found his ideas to mesh with mine in any really stimulating way as of now. That's all I can tell you.
So these organs affect each other in a physical way, and then they affect the transphysical.
Right.
And then the transphysical affects the physical organs.
Right.
So there's like it's and we drew that diagram last week, I think it was, showing the crisscrossing and there's just so many different really complicated.
Well, you know, on one hand, you can say it's complicated, and it is, but there's another way to look at it, which is that it's relativizing. So what I mean by this is that in the mental mutation, we have become habitually accustomed to thinking in terms of substances in time and space. And between substances in time and space, we can create very simple mathematical sets of relations that make us think we understand things, right? But in a world of interdependent origination, which is the world of process thought, everything is related to everything else all the time, right? So that every single actual occasion is a function of all past actual occasions, and the infinite number of eternal objects are all involved in the putting together of each actual occasion. And so we're dealing with complexity, which is infinite all the time. Every actual occasion is infinitely complex. I mean, just as one little thing, Whitehead talks about how all of the initial causal prehensions of the world, as they're prehended, always the word he uses is, has a beautiful word, but the basic, mutually sensitive, right? And so what I prehend from looking at you or what I prehend from looking at you, it's not that I first make a decision about you and then make a decision about you, but all the decisions that I make about all these initial causal prehensions, of which there are an infinite number, are all mutually sensitive to each other as establishing the conditions for the ultimate concrescence. Right? So this is more than infinite processing power involved in the initial stage of concrescence. Right? So the whole thing just becomes flooded with infinity at every level. And so rather than saying it's complex, we can say it comes closer to reflecting the actual infinite complexity of our world, right? And it has the function of relativizing individuality, which I think is really important, right? I think it's all clear to all of us that in deficient mental, our overemphasis on the isolated individual personal substance has become immensely toxic. And so this relativization is an important piece of work. So we have to become accustomed to thinking in terms of different sets of infinite complexities and how they interact with each other. It's a whole new way of thinking.
Can you say that again? What's become immensely toxic?
The overemphasis on the individual ego. There's nothing exceptional there, right?
Yeah. As being good or bad.
As just being. In other words, we have gotten to the point in our culture where individual self-interest has become a religious good, right? Which basically means that we worship evil. And so it's kind of a toxic situation, and so it would be nice to fix that. And one way to fix that is by reminding ourselves over and over again that we are not simple individual substance, but infinitely complex processes of universal relationship. Right?
Yeah, I was thinking about how someone might say, well, just smile and change your attitude and you'll get healthy. But then you can also get healthy by, you know, like what you eat and your care of your physical body. So there seems to be all these different relationships with, you know.
Exactly.
And everyone always comes up with like this really simple explanation where if you just do this, you'll be, you know, fine. And a lot of them work. I mean, we get a lot of different bizarre holistic methods that work for health and psychology, and see the interrelatedness of all these dimensions. No one's ever really found, like, oh, this always works all the time.
No, because they're all too simple. Because it really is that complex.
Yeah, because it really is that complex.
It really is that complex. And at some point, we operate in and through finite minds. Finite mind is a particular capacity, right? And it's the capacity for rationally ordering perceptual experience into a coherent world. And finite mind operates in terms of finite entities and finite concepts, right? But as Sri Aurobindo says, through an inward and upward self-unfolding, we can open up into the infinite mind, of which our finite mind is an expression. And therefore we can learn to be comfortably think in terms of infinities, because that pall of ignorant finitude will be removed. Like that inhibiting function of finitude will be removed from our minds, and we'll be able to think infinitely as the divine does.
Have you been able to do that?
No. I've had moments of being able to think better than I usually do. Like in early morning, half awake sleep, and I can see lots of insights and even sort of see God, right? But I've never had the full experience of a full spiritual awakening like that. Hmm.
I'm just wondering if you feel like most forms of psychotherapy actually potentially enable this toxic overemphasis upon the ego, or if you feel like they emancipate that.
It's a very broad question. I would say that many forms of psychotherapy do assume a distinctly non-spiritual view of the human being and can be very toxic. I think psychotherapy you really can't say what psychotherapy is, because every psychotherapist is doing something different. But the theories of psychotherapy, even transpersonal, have been sort of weak from my point of view. And we don't have what I would like to see somebody do is a full yogic psychology, which is based on the one hand on process of thought, and on the other hand based on Sri Aurobindo's conception of our relationship to God, and how that functions in relation to everyday pathology. Because in my own psychotherapeutic practice, I've become convinced that ultimately the only thing that really helps is a change of aim to a more spiritual aim. And short of that, everything else is just moving around deck chairs on a Titanic, maybe bring a little bit of comfort, maybe somebody gets to speak up a little more in class or whatever, but they don't really change unless it's a spiritual change, a deep change of aim. And it's because basically all psychological problems can be, I'm sure this is an overstatement, but many psychological problems are a simple result of the fact that we're so multiple. We have so many different sub-personalities fighting with each other, with their own aims, and the internal conflict, It's like the Buddha said, all suffering is a result of primitive beliefs about reality and conflicting emotions. Right. So I do think our psychology needs to be more deeply spiritualized and processed. And that would help. I think a lot of therapists do great work, and I think many therapists do their work.
I just have a clarification question.
Yes.
So we have our consciousness, we have some organ consciousnesses, and then you say that the higher the grade, the less abstraction and objectification occurs between entities of that grade. So mental occasions can more fully realize.
That's right.
But what about a higher occasion to a lower occasion? A higher occasion more fully objectified
yes.
the lower occasion than the lowers can affect
yes.
the other. Okay,
yes.
But that was, I thought you were saying the opposite.
No, let me make sure I get this right. Higher occasions can objectify lower grade occasions better than they can themselves.
Yeah.
That's what physics is. Right? Physics is the study of low grade occasions by high grade occasions.
Right. So, well, thinking like about the heart, like my heart can comprehend her heart.
Right.
And then my brain can comprehend my heart better than hearts can comprehend each other.
That's a really interesting question. You see, that's not entirely clear to me.
Well, you say it in a couple places, and in another place it seems like you're saying that mental occasions comprehend each other fully, and then vital occasions comprehend each other fully because they're so similar. So.
Okay. I don't know exactly what I say, but here's what I'd like to say. is that the higher the grade of an occasion, the more fully it objectifies occasions of its own grade, or lower.
Or lower, okay.
Or lower. I probably didn't say that, it's probably important. But as you're speaking, by this heart and head thing, I suddenly realized I'm not sure the highest grade concrescences are in the head. I think that they may be in the heart. The heart would be our highest mental organ. Mm-hmm. Maybe higher in the mental plane than the actual brain consciousness.
Yeah.
Right? In other words, the brain, if the brain is the seat of a consciousness, it's probably the seat of the manas, or the sixth consciousness. That's what it looks like, because it's the place where all the sense organs are coordinated and all the motor effectors are coordinated. And so probably the brain organ is the seat of the manas, or the sixth consciousness. And our actual personality, it might have the heart as its center, or it might not have the heart as its center. It probably has the heart as a center. Have we done the heart exercise in this class? Okay, it takes 1 minute. Everybody close your eyes. Now point to yourself. Okay, everybody open your eyes. Everybody but Caleb pointed to the heart. So most people, just automatically, when they think me, with their eyes closed, they point right here. Okay? Now, Carl Jung thought that only a certain very psychotic modern people point to their heads.
My name means big-hearted.
You have a big heart. But anyway, so maybe this is where the eyes could be located. That would make more sense. So,
high
of grade. Yes, exactly.
And then you have another circle where you
are. Maybe you are already mystic and your heart is here and your mind is here.
It's so big. This book tends to stay in the mental level in the book. Okay. So then briefly, let's just look at chapter figure 2, and then I'll have most of the insights from this chapter, I think. And this is the diagram that we've been basically discussing already. It's the same one I put up on the board the other day. Which goes, what you're saying, Caleb, is the interactions along each plane, between the planes. I know I didn't put all the cross X's on here that I did last time, right? Where my vital influence is your physical and so forth. I should have put those in bubble. But you get the idea here, right? The main point is that the communication that's going on between us is mainly transphysical. And any attempt to explain it all in terms of physical signals is doomed to fail because it's just excessively abstract. And so all of our psychology, all of our sociology, all that stuff needs to be rethought on the basis of the ways in which we do in fact communicate, which are much deeper and much richer than scientists have allowed themselves to imagine.
Ever. Well, I just mean at one point it was was all magical communication.
Oh, right.
You know, so we've gone through these different ways of thinking. We found the answer of how it works and excluded the other ways. And
that's right. So this integral consciousness is the opportunity for us to put all these things together. Okay. Anything else about that chapter? I want to take a minute, take a look, see if there are any questions. I want to spend most of the time on chapter 11.
Yeah. How do the physical bodies born? How do the different consciousnesses decide who gets to be a body where?
I believe that the stories are, for example, in the Bardot Todal and others, is that it's the soul that decides to incarnate. And then the soul gathers up some mental matter and some astral matter, sort of the nucleus of the personality. And then it goes out looking for an embryo. Now, according to the Tibetan Book of the Dead, I'm not sure how literally I take it, but according to the Tibetan Book of the Dead, the soul then finds itself wandering around the universe at the speed of sound, feeling absolutely desperate to get grounded somehow. And so if the soul's absolutely desperate, it'll take the very first womb it can find, even if it's the womb of an animal, right, or a worm or something, right? But that as the soul becomes more developed, it can wait longer, it has more patience, it can make better choices, and so it can actually begin to look not only for human birth, but for favorable human birth. Right? And so that's the idea, is that the choice is somehow made by the soul. That's one myth. I mean, I don't know the exact answer, but that's what Plato would call a likely story. And we can imagine other stories. That would also be interesting, and it would be interesting to see if we can imagine any way of testing it. That's a very interesting question. But that's what the texts say. Okay, any other questions from chapter 10?
Yeah, Ashley's 7 months pregnant. She says she has these conversations with her baby.
Uh-huh.
And it's kind of trippy, like, mm-hmm. because there's this person that's not had any experiences in the world yet that has, like, preferences and things.
Yeah. I believe it. It makes sense to me. All right. So let's talk about reincarnation. This chapter on reincarnation in this book was remarkably right because it turned out way different from what I expected. So I actually learned a lot writing this chapter, and that was fun. The issue of reincarnation has an interesting history. As far as I can put it together, it didn't become a topic of conversation until Greek times, until Plato, really, and Socrates. It wasn't really thought about, and it didn't seem to be a big issue. The magical peoples, I don't really know how they thought about death, but I do know that they had this sense, I think I know, I put together this picture from Gebzer and so forth, that magical peoples had this sense of each moment as arising synchronistically out of mana, out of the potency of the universe, and then dissolving back into it. There was almost no experience of individual ego, but only of a tribal ego. And so obviously death would be a very different kind of thing. And it wasn't the same kind of topic. I mean, I'm sure it was traumatic and they had ways of dealing with it. I'd have to research it, but it didn't come up in the same way it does in the modern world. There's a song I heard the other day. It said, "'Tis the ancestors' words when the fires sound is heard. 'Tis the ancestors' words in the voice of the waters." Right, so there's sort of the sense of this general pool of life, natural life, out of which we emerge and into which we dissolve at death. And so there's a sense that we're just temporary expressions of the one underlying mana. And so death is a very different sort of thing. Right? And then in the mythic period, it's very clear that life and death are considered polarities. And so the alternation between life and death is like the alternation between day and night. And many mythic cultures had the idea that souls would recycle in the tribe. So, you know, the grandfather would be reincarnated, the grandchild and so forth. And so there was much more of a sense of intimacy with death. And the sense of death is natural and is cyclical, right? And so there was, again, much less anxiety about death as a general subject. But when you get to the mental mutation, things really change. Because as I pointed out, it's the mental mutation that presents the world to us as a theater for the enactment of individual human purposes. Right? Make sense? Right? And so it's in the mental world that the whole idea of separate entities is born, and linear time is born. And so the fact that we are finite entities and that we end suddenly becomes terrifying when it's looked at mentally, right? Because now we have a duality of life and death instead of a polarity of life and death. And so all of a sudden, what happens after death becomes an urgent question. And whether or not we reincarnate becomes a topic of philosophical conversation, which has already emerged by the time of Plato. Right? And so really the question in the mental structure of consciousness has been, you know, what happens to the mental ego when the body dies? Right? Where does it go? Right? And so this has been a considerable urgent problem, and may have contributed to the whole dualism of mind and matter. Right? Since if mind is not material, it's easier to imagine it enduring. But in any case, this question of what happens to our personality after we die is a really interesting question and a very important one. So the next question is, how do we analyze it? Like, how do we begin to get some handle on this? Right? And one of the things that occurred to me Well, first let me say I want to make this distinction between reincarnation and life after death. This is a distinction that isn't often necessarily clarified the way it should be. They're entirely logically independent of each other. Reincarnation and life after death, either one is possible, and either one is possible without the other, at least in theory. So the idea of life after death is that there is a transphysical personality that is formed during the life of the physical body with the memories of that life, which continues to function in transphysical worlds after the disintegration of the body. So that's life after death. And what that involves is a lengthening and a complexification of the human life cycle. It says the human life cycle actually starts before birth, the soul's choice, and then it goes after death through these various transphysical worlds on its way back to the soul, right? If there is a soul. Now, so there, that's one idea. So I lost again. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. But reincarnation involves some connection that we have between past lifetimes, right? So it means that this personality, which may or may not survive bodily death, is in some way an extension of a previous personality that may or may not have survived bodily death. And so reincarnation has to do with certain forms of continuity among distinct personalities separate in time and space. And so you see there are different questions, right? And the question is always a question of continuity. The question really comes down to what do we mean by saying the same personality comes back in another body? Or the same personality survives the body of death? What do we mean by same personality? So this is a huge question. And our whole approach to the question, both of life after death and reincarnation, depends upon our answer to the question, what constitutes continuity of personality even during waking life? Right? Where we have personality, radical personality discontinuities in the same body during waking life in a fairly regular way, right? So what is the personality? What is its continuity? How do we identify that? Right? And so I've been making the move to say that the personality is a personally ordered sequence of actual occasions. And the question is now to go more deeply into what constitutes personal order. Right? What is it that continues through the successive occasions of a given personality? And so I proposed, first of all, that there's continuity of memory and continuity of purpose and perhaps continuity of identity. So continuity of memory is pretty obvious, right? It's like we're the same person because we have the memories. You know, there are these things in movies where somebody gets in the wrong body and they convince their buddy they are who they are by sharing memories nobody else could have, right? So continuity of memory in that case is considered a criterion for continuity of personality. There's also continuity of purpose, right? I know I'm the same personality because I'm still trying to carry out purposes that I've been trying to carry out for decades. And so there's continuity of purpose that marks my continuity of personality. And then there's the question of whether or not there is something that is identical among all the elements of a personally ordered society of actual occasions. And we'll come back to that as we go forward. Then I want to make this distinction between two different meanings of continuity. So the normal meaning of continuity in common sense is more or less drawn from physics. And it says that a body is the same body as a previous body, as a previously observed body, if two conditions are fulfilled. One is that the two objects are sufficiently similar. And secondly, that we can trace an uninterrupted trajectory through the relevant space-time connecting the two objects. Right?
You say that one more time?
That we can trace an uninterrupted trajectory
between the two objects in the relevant space-time. So, for example, this cup is the same cup as the one I picked up in the cafeteria, right? Now, you could say, how do you know? Maybe you brought this cup in and it's not the cup you brought. Maybe you substituted the cups or something like that, right? Well, the idea is that somebody with the right memory and the right video equipment could trace an uninterrupted trajectory of how this cup got here from there through space and time with no interruptions, which establishes therefore being the same cup. Right? So that's a particular kind of continuity. And we tend to think of that continuity as being the most important kind. So without philosophical sophistication, most modern people will attribute their unity to the unity of their body. I'm a body, therefore I'm a personality. When my body dies, my personality dies, because that's just how it is. Right? But in a context of process thought, we realize that both continuity of purpose and continuity of memory do not require an uninterrupted trajectory in space-time. So this uninterrupted trajectory in space-time is an idea drawn from classical physics. Right? But in quantum physics, you don't require that, because in quantum physics, an event takes place, it's the causal impact of that event goes into the Schrodinger wave, whatever the hell that is, and it propagates off into time, and it might precipitate later at any point in space and time, with different probabilities, right? And so the same entity can appear here, and then 20 years later, 1,000 miles away, with nothing ever happened in between to that entity. Right? And so now we have a different definition of continuity, which I call process continuity. Process continuity is when personal order continues with some continuity of memory and some continuity of purpose across a gap in the relevant space-time. You know what I'm saying here? It's sort of like in Star Trek, people can beam, right? So everybody's seen Star Trek, and nobody gets bewildered when they watch the beaming process. It's probably not possible, but still, we get the idea. We aren't confused when we see Captain Kirk dissolve in the spaceship and rematerialize on the planet. It doesn't confuse us to think that there's continuity of personality without continuity of physical.
But there is. The parts get broken up and then sent one by one and then reorganized.
The contrary. I'm just trying to use.
No, I'm not.
The point. You can make that argument, and I can't answer it. You're right. It destroys my analogy, and it leaves me scrambling for a new analogy.
I took a class on identity, like 17 years ago, and so all the ones continuity. Like memory, and what happens if you forget your memories? Are you no longer yourself? Right. And they all have those.
You may know more about that than I do.
Well, they just all have their like standard criticisms, and it's a difficult all around. It's difficult to say what identity is.
Exactly. So I'm making a bid here, and you just pointed out one of the problems with my bid. But still, the point remains, whether my analogy holds or not, because quantum physics doesn't for me, is that a causal effect can have a manifestation at a great distance in time and space without having manifested to any other intervening entity. And so we can imagine, therefore, a continuity of personality jumping over a space-time gap, even if beaming doesn't work as an analogy. Damn. Okay.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
I don't know how relevant this would be. It is true. In my own case, I left a village in northern Afghanistan in 1954. I came to America all the way halfway around the world, with a complete different culture, with different ideas of science, technology, and all this. But almost probably the village was a mythic age. But after 4 years, I went back to the village. Mm-hmm. I was there that I thought I just had not left that place at all. Mm-hmm. That moment, everybody I saw recognized. Some contact.
Yeah.
There was no gap in between my being away and going back to the village, although between the village and Los Angeles or UCLA, there are thousands of years different.
Yeah.
In one way of mental, not in really. In some ways, they're much far ahead of the village.
That's right.
But in that case, there is this. When I read that book, I remembered it.
Yeah.
Because there are times that we just, there's no gap. And nobody recognized whether we are or not.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's fascinating, right? That's a really interesting analogy. So that's really, it feels like what I'm trying to communicate here. So the question then, right? Because I'm sure we've dealt with in your class quite a bit, is what binds the members of the personally ordered society? What binds them? And basically what I want to talk about is the continuity of aim, purpose, or character. See, now the reason I want to talk about it this way is because if we try to identify other forms of continuity, we can't do it. There is no empirically observable element which persists unchanging. In the stream of personality. This has been exhaustively investigated by thousands of years of Buddhist meditation. They cannot find anything they can point to that stays the same. And I think that's pretty obvious to us, right? That no two moments are ever the same, and that we cannot find any one single factor that we can point to, any finite factor, that is the same throughout life. A lot of similarity, right? But no identity. And this is the Buddhist no soul theory. There simply isn't a soul, but there is simply a causal, a thickness, an ongoing thickness of causal objectification among sequences of actual occasions, sort of channeling them into a stream. But there's nothing solid in that stream, nothing real, nothing that's identical. It's just circumstantial. It's sort of, is it an ongoing personality is the way the world circumstances sort of tend to organize, to focus streams of objectification in the creative events. But I'm suggesting that aim or purpose or character is another factor that might allow us to identify a deeper level of continuity. Now, I've said that each individual occasion has its own unique aim. And that the aim, the actual aim, the initial subjective aim of an actual occasion has various components. So I'm suggesting that from creativity itself, it gets an aim at value. That is, that Whitehead says every actual occasion necessarily aims at the maximization of value for itself and its relevant future. Meaning that the enjoyment of the anticipation of the future is a very important part of current satisfaction. So that's this basic value that's just built in. And then we also get social values. So that whatever position that our concrescence adopts in the creative advance puts it in the context of many ongoing societies. So, for example, we are all part of the ongoing society of the Earth and of the solar system and of the galaxy and of the universe, and we're also ongoing parts of CIS, the United States of America, all these things, right? So we belong to a very large number of societies, some of which are more relevant to us at different times than others. And from these environing societies, we also inherit aims, right? So for example, our aim at evolution is a universal aim. Right, that conditions each actual occasion in our personality. Right? But at the same time, our feeling for justice is also an aim that we receive in some complex way from our society. Right? And so forth. You get the idea, right?
And so there are social aims that are built in. And then there is also a personal aim. And the personal aim is particularly important from a psychological point of view, because at each actual occasion, there's an initial subjective aim which is given by the universe. But in the course of the concrescence, that aim can be changed. So at an actual occasion has the possibility of changing to some extent its aim. The most classic example of a radical aim shift is a religious conversion, right? Where somebody who's been aiming at selfishness in a fairly sudden way becomes altruistic, right? So there's a deep, fundamental, sudden change of personal aim, which probably took place in a single actual occasion, ultimately, right? But then it was so powerful that it became transmitted through the personality. And assuming the personality is an environment which supports that, it's liable to go on for a lifetime, or not, depending, right? Right. So we have a personal aim, and in every single moment, we are working to shape our personal aim in life. So that at the end of every moment of experience, the things that we have decided to value are more valuable in the next moment. And so every moment in which, for example, I am loving, brings in conformally into my next moment that loving feeling. Now my next moment might reject it and get angry, but assuming that my next moment accepts it and says yes to it, and that keeps happening, that could become a deep shift in my whole value character. And so in some ways, personal aim has a lot to do with personally ordered society. It's only possible in a personally ordered society. And it does seem to be, in a certain sense, the mechanism of spiritual evolution, is this evolution of aim. So we have these three kinds of aims. And then I came up with the idea that there might be an even more basic aim, which would be a soul aim. So the idea here would be that the soul is an entity with a certain kind of aim, and that all of the personalities in which that soul will be incarnated will share some of that aim. In the book I called it its value character. Now, where did this idea of value character come from? It's very highly speculative. But remember we talked about Sri Aurobindo's idea of God becoming many at the level of supermind, right? So God becomes many minds, each one's an individual, each one knows itself as one with the others, and so forth, right? But let's bring into play Leibniz's principle of the identity of indiscernibles, right? If all these multiplications of God that we're talking about are all exactly equal, then we aren't saying anything. We haven't said a word because it's still God and nothing was ever differentiated. So there has to be some way to differentiate the different spirits from each other. Now, how can we do that? Right? So there are two possibilities that are two metaphysical ideas that I have around that. But the one that I'm using here is I'm suggesting that each individual spirit has its own unique style of enjoyment, right? So that one spirit, you know, has a particular enjoyment of the intellect, right? And one has a particular enjoyment of emotional intensity. And of course, there have to be millions of shades of meaning here. I'm just naming some crude distinctions, right? But the idea that each soul is a slightly different way in which God appreciates God's self. And so each spirit, and therefore each soul, has a slightly different value character, or is just a slightly different way of loving the world than the other souls have. And that this is some sort of primordial distinction that operates beyond the finite world, even in the world of the infinite. And so then the soul, as it expresses itself, in any entity in which that soul is incarnated, it would have at its base some sort of continuity of character, a basic value character.
A bliss preference?
A bliss preference. Beautiful. A bliss preference. A slightly different bliss preference. Right?
And God wants to be enjoyed in every way.
Exactly.
And needs different particular entities to enjoy each part of God. And I'm just thinking about conflict between your particular blissfulness and mine, and what happens when they're in conflict and they're trying to...
Yeah, and so now for most of us, probably, this soul character is not very visible, because most of us are generally expressive, more superficially, of, first of all, our social values, and then at a certain higher level of development, our personal values. But only at some very high level of development is the personality pacified enough that this deep soul character can begin to emerge. Right? But this is an hypothesis about continuity through lifetimes. Right? Now remember, according to some of the earlier things we said, that the more similar, if we have two occasions, A and B, the more, and A is in the past and B is in the present, the more similar their aims are, the more fully A will objectify in B. Right? So the closer your aims are to mine, the more easier it is for me to know you deeply. Right? That's a hypothesis here, right? And also, I've been saying that aim has a much bigger function in reality than anybody else has been saying, because I'm claiming that the unity of organisms is a unity of aim. That's what gives organisms their coherence and their self-limiting, self-organizing property, is that they're all pulled together by aim, right? And so aim is a much bigger factor in the actual world in this theory than it's certainly in science, where the existence of which is completely denied.
So when you say personally ordered society occasions, it's not the same as saying a unified aim ordered society of occasions, or a society of occasions to share the same aim. Are those, because...
Okay, good question. I'm defining it, a personally ordered society, as a sequence of action occasions, like beads on a string. But now I'm asking, in what does that continuity more specifically consist? And so I've been mentioning memory, purpose, and now value, character, as elements in this continuity. The Whitehead doesn't analyze it that deeply. I'm trying to go into a deeper analysis of what it is that allows us to be the same person from moment to moment or from lifetime to lifetime. Right? So it seems clear to me that any analysis of the problem of life after death or reincarnation must rest on a theory about the continuity of personality. Otherwise, you've got nothing to work with. Right? So I'm trying to build up some theory of the continuity of personality, and I'm suggesting... Now by the way, if my idea is right, and there is a certain bliss preference that constitutes, that's shared by the members of a personally ordered society, then they would naturally objectify more fully in each other, and therefore there'd be greater memory, right, and also more continuity of purpose. So all these things go together as ways of binding these personally ordered societies into the problem.
It seems to me that, based on this, that the soul aim would be by far the most important and the most causal, because, as you've shown here, you know, we have all these different sub-personalities, and often they have all kinds of different aims that are totally discontinuous.
Yeah.
So, in a sense, that's on the mental and vital level. There's this chaotic, discontinuous, you know, ecology of aims.
That's right.
What's holding it all together is this higher order
aim of
the soul that's exerting its downward influence. Or
that's correct.
Like that.
I think that's absolutely correct. However, without changing the correctness of that, the picture that I get from Sri Aurobindo is that although that's always the case, the soul takes pleasure in submitting itself to the superficialities of life. so that, you know, the soul incarnates for some reason. It doesn't have to. So, look, I've really been feeling this. I keep telling you guys I'm reading this book on the Gita. And Sri Aurobindo evokes so beautifully what it would be like to be an enlightened karma yogi, an enlightened master of action. He talks about how we would be, in our inner consciousness, we would be living in a complete clarity and purity and uninterruptible calm and bliss every single moment, right? And that all the things of the world, we'd be seeing them, right? And we'd be watching the reactions, right? We'd be participating actively, but nothing would trouble us because we would be so deeply immersed in our own intrinsic sense of self-existent bliss that everything happening in the world would just be part of the game, and we would just be sort of doing it out of our corner, my back pocket as it is, with no urgency. You know, it's like Arjuna could go out and slaughter all his relatives and not feel a thing. He's just happy, he's enlightened, you know, slaughtering them. So this is this image, right? And the image, right, of being able to live in absolute peace and total knowledge and complete participation in the lives of all beings, to be motivated by nothing but divine compassion, so that one's body becomes merely a pathway for the evolving will of God as it's expressed in the world. It sounds really nice. Yeah, when you said it's like better than the Bahamas, right? But I notice in my own life that I'm not mature enough to go for it. Right? Like, it's just incredible. I'm reading this book and I get inspired every day. It's like it's helping me stay alive to read this book and to get this wonderful spiritual orientation. And I can see, oh wow, I get it. I see how it works now. Like, if I could just completely pull my attention inside and not get disturbed about all these outside desires and instead focus all of my attention on God, what could be more beautiful, right? And if I do that, after long enough, I'll begin to experience my own divinity, and the bliss of that experience will be so great that it'll make all external pleasures pale by comparison. And so all my troubles about life will dissolve into this completely blissful movement of powerful, compassionate action. It's great, right? And I'm not doing it, right? I mean, you know, it's like I spend part of every day thinking about God, and my intellect really is practically converted, right? If my intellect was in control, that's all I'd do. But it's not, right? My vital body wants other things, you know? Members of the opposite sex, comfortable bed, and good food, right? And like, I'm looking at it, and I'm thinking, those things are all completely transitory. They're all clearly more trouble than they're worth. Right? The only thing that's worth anything is God giving me a permanent solution to total bliss, right? And I still want those finite things, right? I mean, actually, I still spend a lot of my energy pursuing those things. I've been watching myself all week. It's been fascinating. I can really see the path that Sri Aurobindo is talking about. It's visible to me now. Like when I was a Buddhist and meditated countless hours for year after year, I didn't really get what I was doing or why. Right? I mean, I had some vague idea. I was inspired. My teacher told me to meditate, so I meditated, right? Now I feel like I understand it. Now I see what that was for and what it means, right? And yet, my being is not mature enough to completely abandon myself to the divine.
I've been thinking about this issue for most of my life. and just recently saw a presentation on spiritual bypass, and it just tied into a lot of the reading that I've been doing too, and reincarnation. And that maybe that's actually not the point of this earth school. Maybe our soul work is to deal with each other in the mundane, and if we were totally in this sort of nirvana-like state that you're describing,
But the thing is, it's important, because the thing I'm describing is not that. I'm describing a state of being fully and absolutely involved in life, way more than we are now, with less fear, more action, more compassion, more intimacy, more bliss, while simultaneously aware of ourselves as grounded in the divine.
Right.
So I'm very explicitly not advocating any kind of quietistic or negative sense of nirvana.
It's the evolved involution.
Yeah.
Yeah, evolved, involution.
Fully involuted and
fully evolved.
Yeah, exactly.
It seems, my point is that at that, like, achieving that state, it would seem like you would supersede the need to be on Earth. Like, you would be like, a bodhisattva.
By the way, a bodhisattva, never leaves the Earth. The whole definition of a bodhisattva, I took the bodhisattva vow, and my vow was never to leave the Earth, mm-hmm. until, never to leave the universe until every sentient being had become enlightened. So the bodhisattva ideal is all about staying on the earth forever and renouncing enlightenment. That's, the bodhisattva vow consists in renouncing personal enlightenment. Right? So this is a complicated issue, but I refer you in particular to the Bhagavad Gita, which is the text which most centrally deals with this kind of issue of difference between, basically is talking about two different kinds of renunciation. Right? He says there's a kind of renunciation where you renounce the earth, right? And so you get the idea that activity is karma, and karma is bondage, and so you don't want to stop acting. So these ascetics will go off into caves and try to stop eating and become breatharians and just try to completely minimize their interaction with the world so they can just go away, right? And Sri Aurobindo says, the Bhagavad Gita makes the case that that's not renunciation, because even sitting still is a very potent form of action. And so the real renunciation is not the renunciation of action, but the renunciation of the attachment to the fruits of the action. Right? The renunciation of the greed and the lust in the action. Right? And so if you can get to a point where you can be calm and blissful in the midst of the world, then what comes through you into the world is the bliss and the compassion and the wisdom. Right? So what you're renouncing is an inner renunciation to the attachment of the fruits, but it's not an outer renunciation of action, which is actually impossible, according to the Bhagavad Gita. And it's fascinating. And Aurobindo's writings on the Gita are just I'm so nourished by them. The last couple of weeks are just beautiful. So, but your issue that you're bringing up is exhaustively examined, and I think well answered in that literature. Okay, let's take a break. Yeah, let's take a break. Let's come back. As I was saying earlier, the whole issue of personal identity and the importance of personal identity is an historical factor, right? It's like the reason we care so much about reincarnation right now is because we're mental beings in linear time and so forth. And the theories that I've been developing here show us that our individual identity is much more relative to the universe than we had imagined it was. And so this relativization of individuality also leads to a great complexification of the idea of reincarnation itself. Right? Because now it's not just like there's a single substance, that's the personality that could hop from here to a new body, right? We now have a much more complex situation. And one theory that comes up, and this is a theory that Sean Kelly strongly advocates, and also I think at one point at least Frank Peletti was very favorable to this, is the idea that every personality is a reincarnation of every other personality. Right? So the idea here is that, you know, the past contains all these lived lives, and because the entire past objectifies in us, we have the possibility of remembering or re-experiencing all or any of those lives. And so when some particular emotional circumstance in our life arises, it may trigger a prehension that comes to consciousness of somebody's past life in which a relevant situation occurred, right? And so we can imagine that all personalities are reincarnated in each personality. And that way, on the one hand, there is reincarnation, but we each only get one life. And Sean really likes this because it's compatible with Catholic theology. So it integrates Catholic theology with reincarnation. But in process thought, it's also true. It is, in fact, the case that in some important sense, every being that ever lived, and certainly every human that ever lived, is incarnated in us. Right? Because we have something of their experience in us. And so in a certain sense, there's sort of a reincarnation light, which says, no, there may not be any continuity of this personality, but there is this general universal continuity of experience which can be interpreted as a sort of universal ongoing reincarnation process. Right? And that seems true, and it is one mechanism of reincarnation. Now, the second one here is called reincarnation as continuity of personality without physical continuity, with variable continuity of memory, no survival. I like that. But the basic idea is this, is that we do, in fact, have what I consider to be decisive scientific evidence for the fact of reincarnation. And this decisive evidence is accumulated by Ian Stevenson earlier in the century. And what he did was he began to study the phenomena of childhood memory of past lives. So it turns out that with some definite statistical regularity, children at the ages of 2 to 5, something like that, will suddenly begin having memories of past lives. And they'll say, you're not my real mommy, my mommy is so-and-so. And they'll say, where's my dog, so-and-so? And things like this. And they'll often report how they died in the past life and where they were, right? So Stevenson got onto this, and he began to hear about these stories, and instantly he traveled to wherever they were before the story gotten out, you know, and he would then listen to the kid and try to figure out where the other town was, and then he'd go to the other town, and he'd find the mom, who sure enough had the name she had, and the dog was there, and everything, right? And so over and over again, he could verify these stories. And not only that, but very frequently, the new body had birthmarks that corresponded to the cause of death in the past life. Right? So in one case, this little kid had been shot in the throat with a shotgun, right? And he had this big splotch on his throat, right? But then when they looked on his scalp under his hair, he had little scars for all exit wounds too, right? That's kind of pretty trippy, right? And so these cases, there are hundreds and hundreds of these cases, and they're entering into a statistical database, and they're getting all these incredible correlations, right? And so I consider this to be completely reliable scientific proof that at least one form of reincarnation does take place. So reincarnation is actual. Now, this particular type of reincarnation does not seem to be the general rule. Because, for one thing, most of us don't have memories of our children in past lives, and because most of us don't die early. And almost all these cases were people who died early and violently. And so there seems to be some sort of idea implied that if you die early and violently, you haven't done what you came here to do, so you come back pretty quick and you come back relatively close by to sort of try the same thing again. Right? That sort of seems to be the general idea. But again, so this is a continuity of personality without physical continuity. In other words, the personality stays in existence, it dies, it remains in existence continuously, but not of the physical world, and then it enters a new body and becomes reborn. Right? So here we have a type of reincarnation involving continuity of personality without physical continuity, and with variable continuity of memory. That is, the memories are more or less, right? And also, most of these cases do not necessarily involve any personality survival or death, because in about 80% of these cases, there's just the memory of the past life, but no memory of anything in between the two lives. And so we can then posit this particular reincarnation mechanism where under certain circumstances, a personality will die and then simply be reborn into another body without having gone through, you know, all these other states and so forth, without having gone through all the subtle worlds. It just makes a direct transfer of consciousness. So this appears to be one possible mechanism of reincarnation. Yeah.
It makes sense in relation to what you said earlier about how, you know, if someone dies and they're confused and whatever, that they're just going to jump in the next womb. And so if they just,
yeah,
young child dies in a traumatic way, and there's so much emphasis, right, too, on the state of consciousness that one's in death, and if it's traumatic, it's like,
yeah,
confused, and then you dive back in the next body. And that's then nice. Why are these children particularly report on these things? They didn't have the intermittent time, perhaps, to process, you know, the experience from that life. And so
that's an interesting theory. Going, yeah. And also, I would add to that, is that memory, as we know, is almost invariably triggered by something in the current environment. Right? And so if you're reborn in an environment very similar to the one you just died in, there would be a lot of memory triggers that would tend to awaken the memory. Whereas if you were to be reborn in a very different time and place, there wouldn't be those triggers that would be less likely to arise. Okay. So this is one type of personality, one type of reincarnation, and it does seem to happen. I mean, there is real, strong scientific proof that this does indeed take place. And that's one mechanism. Now, some percent, approximately 10% of these cases that Stevenson reports, he calls them court cases of the reincarnation type. And 10% of them are court I, which means cases of the reincarnation type with intermission memories, right? So about 10% of these cases, in fact, do report what happened between their death and their rebirth. And these stories have been collected. They're doing statistical analyses on them, but they include things like one kid said he spent a long time sitting in a tree and just watching people come and go. And then finally somebody came by and he thought, I like that guy. And he followed him home and got into his wife's womb.
Oh, my goodness.
And they report on what they have to do to get into the mother's womb, right? So there are stories like they have to enter a particle of rice or a piece of dust and get the dust into the water so the mother will drink it. But sometimes the mother will think the water is dirty and will throw it away. They'll have to do it again, right? And so there are all these very elaborate stories of what happens in between death and rebirth. And these are kids, you know, they're not exactly sophisticated to make up all these stories, right? I mean, this is reporting what they experienced. So this is another type of reincarnation in which there is direct reincarnation, but there is continuity of consciousness between successive incarnations and clear intermission memories. It happens to be the case that 10% in which there is intermission memories also have a great deal more accurate memories of the past life. So more hits, reliable, right? So it appears that there's probably greater consciousness and greater continuity throughout. It's very possible, the theosophists say, that if you live a very dreamy life, then your afterlife will be dreamy. You won't have hardly any impact on it. And so it's possible that some of these children just sort of dream through the intermission and don't really form any memories, whereas some of them are more lucid and therefore do form those memories and also have greater continuity of memory from lifetime to lifetime. But this is really important.
Right.
I mean, we have scientific proof of reincarnation. Isn't that cool? Right? That's like you take it out of the front page of the New York Times, right? But there it is. We do have the proof. Conclusive, scientific, well-documented proof. So now we have these two different kinds of reincarnation. One is the general way we're all reincarnating with each other. And one is that in certain cases, three cases. So in one case, we die and are more or less immediately reborn in another body. In some cases, there's a death with an intermission, which is remembered and which seems to happen in a more or less physical-like world. And then there's a reincarnation. That's another mechanism for reincarnation. Another one, and this comes from the work of a guy named Whiteman, who's a very obscure South African philosopher and mystic who wrote very dense and incomprehensible texts, but I happen to have met his one disciple and read his disciple's paper, and it had this really interesting idea in it. which is that there can be various kinds of partial reincarnation. So, for example, when I die, it might be that the personality which is now inhabiting my heart might go off and incarnate in somebody else's heart. Or it might go off and incarnate in somebody as its presiding personality. Right? And so all these different intelligences in our bodies that are also evolving intelligences, they, when we die, now, immediately after death, if we survive bodily death, I presume that most of these consciousnesses remain together to form the transphysical personality. But over time, as the transphysical bodies dissolve, because they're also mortal, those personalities might go off and reincarnate in all different kinds of ways, right? And so just like we all know that heart transplants bring personality changes from the old body, you guys know about that, right? So in the same way, it could be that my heart is a reincarnation of the heart of some bum who died on the street 30 years ago in San Francisco, right? So there it is, right? So lots of different ways reincarnation can take place because there are so many beings in us which have big parts of our memories and could go off and incarnate in different ways at different times. So reincarnation is not just total, right? There can be all kinds of partial reincarnation. And then there are the soul-based theories of reincarnation. By the way, the Buddhists also have a theory of direct reincarnation with nothing intermediate. The very early Buddhists had this idea that there was nothing but a continuity of karma, which is to say that I would die, and that at some point in the future another life would start, but that by some mechanism, that life would causally objectify my life very fully, either because it's similar in circumstance or similar in value character, as I would suggest, or something like that that joins the two lifetimes together causally. But there's no soul. There's just sort of an ongoing causal sequence that has physical interruptions in it. Right? But then there are the soul-based theories of reincarnation, which I find more interesting. And in this particular chapter, I developed the soul idea in a different way. I talked about how, as occasions of higher grade objectify each other more and more fully, let's imagine that going all the way to the limit. And let's imagine occasions so high grade that there is no abstraction in objectification between them. And so, in effect, they all completely share each other's experiences. And that would be the soul level, or Sri Aurobindo's overmind level. And so we can imagine these beings that still have a different style of appreciation, but in effect, they all share the exact same body and the exact same world and the exact same memories, but they each appreciate them differently. And this would be the soul level. It's one way.
Do you use soul levels akin to the overmind level?
I've been talking about it that way. Let me clarify this point. The idea that the soul is at the overmind level, or what the theosophists call the causal level, is a theosophical idea. I got it from Alice Bailey, and I'm using it because it's very elegant. Sri Aurobindo is saying something different, but I don't know what he's saying. Because Sri Aurobindo, at one point, makes a big deal how instead of having seven levels, he's having eight, with one of them being the soul. And Getzer makes this whole thing about the move from seven to eight being indicative of the move to the integral. And also, when I'm reading Savitri, you know, this whole sort of seven-layer scheme makes sense. You know, he's going through all the transphysical worlds, and it gets up into the higher worlds, and I'm kind of following it all right. And then all of a sudden, he jumps out of the sequence and goes to the world of the soul. And then he jumps back into the sequence, right? So I don't exactly know what he was getting at, right? He seemed to be apprehending the soul as some kind of different principle that was somehow not able to be fit into this general cosmological scheme that he presented and I'm presenting. So I have this open question about the soul, but the way I'm developing the idea here, by bringing abstraction and objectification to zero, works if we assume that the soul is at the overmental level. So I have questions about this.
I don't claim to be an Aravinda expert, but my working interpretation is more like the soul, for me, it has more to do with the level of illumined mind.
Oh, that's interesting. That doesn't make sense to me, though. So we'll have to talk about that after class. That's an interesting idea. Yeah, of course.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Because I thought that the finite actual occasion started in the mental level and below.
Yeah.
So if the soul is at the overmind level, it would be an infinite.
Yes.
But I thought you made some reference in here to soul occasions actually being finite.
Please clarify. If I did, it was a mistake. They should be infinite because there's no abstraction and objectification. They couldn't be finite. Because finitude, in my idea, is a consequence of abstraction and objectification, so the soul should be infinite.
Oh, I guess just the fact that the soul reincarnates, so it's going through an evolution.
It is.
So it's an infinite sense it's going through an evolution.
Yeah, in other words, the soul is an individual that is one with its universe. It's an individual perspective on the universe, but it's a perspective that's so comprehensive that it knows others as well as it knows itself. Right? So imagine that there was no abstraction and objectification between you and me. Right? I would know you as well as I know me. But that wouldn't mean we wouldn't be separate beings.
But how can you evolve if you're not in time?
The soul is in time. And its infinity doesn't mean it's not involved in time.
Oh, it doesn't?
No.
But also, in the chart that I found of the planes of Sri Aurobindo, overmind is still within the planes of finite existence. Supermind is above overmind and is the first one at the
plane. Yeah, that's
of
correct.
Infinite but, existence.
Yeah, you're right. But overmind is a little different. It's the border.
Right, it's the golden lid
in it, right?
Right.
And so clearly it's not supermental, and it's not as infinite as a supermental in this precise way. In the supermind, the individual beings know themselves to be one with the transcendent divinity which is manifest in them. At the overmental level, they don't know that, but they do know they're one with each other. And there is some kind of participation in time at the overmental level. It's eternal time. And the spirit is timefulness or timelessness, whatever you want to call it. But the soul does participate in the evolutionary time, but it does so in an eternal way that it has no sense of... It doesn't. It's not a finite span of time that it occupies. It occupies all of it. So there are various soul-based theories of reincarnation, and I like thinking about the soul this way as being sort of the unity of all of our personalities. And then we can say that when each actual occasion, when it's born, has the value character of some soul. Right? So some soul is incarnated in every actual occasion. Right? Now, it may be, for example, that one soul is incarnated in all hydrogen atoms. Doesn't have to be a separate soul for every atom. And the Theosophists, in fact, claim that group souls are the norm, and that as the evolution proceeds, the group souls become sort of curdled. And so at a certain point, which is the point of the domestic animals, they say that the domestic animals have become curdled enough that through interactions with human beings, they become initiated into the human status. And so it's after being a pet that an animal will come back as a human. And we're actually functioning as spiritual initiators for our pets and teaching them how to be human. And that only humans are one soul for one body and all the rest of the beings are group souls. Who knows, right? It's kind of a nice story. Right? It's very charming. Okay, so the thing about these if we take the soul in this way, then the process of reincarnation becomes even much more complex. So, for example, we can imagine one soul incorporating as hydrogen throughout the universe, right? Or one soul incarnating as mice, you know. But we can also imagine a soul incarnating as a number of different human individuals all alive at the same time. No problem, right? And so there really could be such a thing as a soulmate, right? And you could meet somebody who's an incarnation of the same soul that you are. They wouldn't necessarily be a good mate for you, but they'd probably be interesting. It appears, it depends on how elaborately you want to construct your idea of time, but if you want to start getting involved, for example, in the many worlds theory, then there's no reason that the soul can't be incarnated in many different times simultaneously. Right? So I had this picture once where I pictured that the universe was like the inside of a big pipe, cylinder, right? And so we're now inside the cylinder, and there's this screw thread that goes through the whole thing, right? And so this screw thread is like time, right? And so if we stretch the thread out, so this is the thread, right? You've got an occasion here, and then you've got an occasion here, an occasion here. This is a universal occasion here, a universal occasion, and so forth, right? But then the soul might... It's going along, let's look at this as an individual, okay? And it's incarnating along this line, and then it thinks, God, I made a bad mistake. And so it goes back to this moment, and it opens up a new line, right? But it wouldn't even have to be a new line. I'm sorry, I'm saying this very badly. Let me start again, okay? Let's imagine that life is like a marquee in Las Vegas, okay? You've got a long line of lights. Right. And so an individual lifetime is the lights illuminating this group all the way across.
What's a marquee?
Right? What?
What's a marquee?
It's a big display. Okay, but just picture, really simple, just a row of light bulbs. And these light bulbs have the capacity to shine an infinite number of colors, okay? And so this bulb lights up, it's got a certain color, and then this bulb lights up the same color, and this bulb lights up, and so you're looking at it from outside, you can see this line of lights going across, right? So that's one lifetime, right? But meanwhile, so the guy who was living here is now living here, right? But this guy might do something really different, right? And so even though as this guy keeps going along, he still remembers his past, right? But somebody did something different over here, and so now there's a whole other line going through. And so there could be all these different timelines unfolding through the same time sequence, right? You can imagine a new Big Bang happening every minute, right? And we're just part of this one Big Bang. Or you can get really complicated, right? We don't know. I mean, it seems pretty unlikely that the entire universe is a single linear time stream, right? That just seems kind of not very interesting, right? So it must be much more complex than that. And depending on how complex we want to construct our space-time with parallel worlds and so forth and so on, we can imagine a soul that incarnates multiple times in a single period, is simultaneously incarnated in different areas of time. And so the whole process of reincarnation, you see, has now become immensely relativized and complex. A, we're all reincarnations of each other and of everybody else. B, we know that in certain cases our personality leaves our body and goes directly into another body, sometimes with intermission memories. We know that there are soul-based theories of reincarnation, and in most of these soul-based theories of reincarnation, there's also an intermediate period. And so the sort of standard story seems to be this, that our physical body dies, we wake up in our astral body in the dream world. Depending upon our conditions as a personality in waking life, we enjoy that life to whatever extent we can. It dies, we go into the mental world, enjoy some blissful experience there. It dies, and then we go back to the soul. And then there's some period of digestion, and the story starts again. That's sort of the standard model I read most places. But as we see,
but you don't
even
start
if that's
again.
True, what?
You don't start again.
Someone else starts again, but they have the same soul. They're an expression of the same soul, which means they have the same value character, which means there's karma because the identity of value character causes the more full objectification of those past experiences in the current lifetime. Right? But meanwhile, all these other types of reincarnation are also going on simultaneously. And so the point is that we are all mixed and matched at such a deep level. Not only are we all the same being, so it couldn't get more intimate than that, right? But we're also reincarnations of each other. We have organs that come from other people. We're parts of other people. Our personality complexes are probably shared in the transphysical worlds. I mean, really, we are much less distinct from each other than we imagine we are. And the ways in which we reincarnate are multiple and complex. And the destiny of the personality is hard to measure. And if we put a soul in there, it starts to make more sense, right? But it's still difficult, right? So the main point of this work that I did was to show how much we're parts of each other and how really complex the reincarnation issue is and how many different ways it must be taking place. Right, which also I think is integral because the idea of the soul, of having a single personality one at a time going sequentially, is very mental and very limited and does not do justice to the insights of the mythic or the magical ancestors, which this theory does make room for. And so I like it.
So, I'm just thinking if you're putting off your the reincarnation allows for us to continue on after we die, and I think that's one of its appeals.
Yeah.
But if you only continue on into the transphysical, but then you end up eventually dying.
Right.
Still a limitation of the self.
If there's only survival but no reincarnation, there's a limit. That's right.
But even if you reincarnate, as different than what you were living as. Like taking on new personality conflicts, get rid of some of them, then it seems to me that's not still you anymore. And
You're right.
I mean, the attraction to have you continue on into the afterlife or even to a next physical life is that there's not just a continuity of karmic memory, but there's a continuity of aim, of identity, in more ways. Whereas, like, I just, yeah.
Yeah, well, like I say, you're asking a great question. It seems pretty clear to me that personalities don't reincarnate. I don't think there'll ever be another Eric Weiss.
Yeah, that doesn't make sense to me either.
Right? But I do have a sense that something about me is immortal.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so I like to imagine that, at least initially, as a soul. And then my question is, so what is it about me that's immortal? In other words, what is it about me that remains the same from moment to moment? Now, there is some continuity of memory, although it's quite variable, even in waking life. So that can't be the main criteria. And there's certainly continuity of purpose, which again, is relative, right? And so I'm suggesting that which remains the same about us is our bliss style.
Yeah, that seems to make sense to me.
Right, and that bliss style is the expression of an actual being, which is the soul.
Which is really Eric?
Well, no, Eric is really that. In other words, I am an expression of that. I exist for it. Hmm. Right? I am its way of having experience in the world. It's like I'm its root, and it's shot down to have some experience, right?
Hmm.
And it will pull back. So it's the real person. The personality, Eric, is not the real person. Can't be. Because it's completely dependent on circumstances. Right? How could it be me if drugs change it so much? If all these things change it so much? It's not me. It's just what I call me is an ongoing set of circumstances. Really, right? And it's hard to identify with that as something which is permanent. Because it's not. Okay, so whatever is permanent can't be anything empirical in the ordinary sense of that term. It can't be any finite factor. But I'm suggesting it's possible that it could be this bliss style, or this value character, that really is sort of, it's the way we are differentiated within the divine. That we are spiritually individualized in the divine as specialized organs for a peculiar appreciation of bliss. And that bliss character remains with us through all our incarnations, and that the being to which the bliss character belongs is a conscious being, but in a very different way, because it has a universal consciousness rather than an individual consciousness. And so my soul knows that I am an individualization of the universe. It knows that. It's clear about it. But it still enjoys its experiences through me.
Well, you know, when I play role-playing games, it's like I can have a lot of different characters, but Caleb always seems to show up
exactly
in those characters. So I might be a warrior, but I'm going to play the warrior as a, you know, because I want to do certain things.
Exactly.
It's sort versus of like that. An elf.
Right? And the soul is the accumulator of wisdom. Right? We can imagine the soul, for example, we could develop a theory of soul in Whitehead's system by claiming that the consequent nature of God is the family of souls. And that would work, I think. I haven't tried to get the details to line up, but I think it'll work to individualize the consequent nature of God. By the way, Whitehead's very last written essay is called Immortality. And it's very beautiful and very obscure. And it may hint at some of the things I'm saying. Some of the things I'm saying might be used as an attempt to interpret his last essay, which is quite fascinating. But he does talk in that essay about the immortal aspects of personality. So, now, it's 2:15. Do you guys want to break up for discussion or just keep on discussing for the next half hour? What's your preference? Okay. Okay. So I've pretty much presented what I was going to present, and so now it's up to you to take us further. Yeah.
I guess what Caleb's pointing to is the same question that I struggle with daily is, you know, in all of this circumstances of personality and this constant questioning, like, who am I actually? And while I think on a wisdom level, on a spiritual level, I know that answer. You know, I feel that it's because you forget so often, it always feels like I'm having to remind myself. And I keep feeling like this is an interesting way of talking about the soul and everything else in a way that reminds us that we're not our personalities. Because I feel like if anything that people want to identify with the most is personality.
That's right.
And so I think this is a really interesting way of looking at it, like other traditions do, that we're not the personality. And to remember how changing the personality is according to all the realms, all the mental world, the astral world, how our personality is also affected by all that at the same time.
That's right.
So,
and it also provides a reference point.
Yeah.
For psychological health. Right? One of the problems with psychotherapy, going back to your question, is that it really doesn't have any good definition of health. It just doesn't have any clue, right, what that means, right? And so psychology finds us at this particular stage of evolution in which we're awake enough to be noticing the divine in intellect and art and sex and trees and plants and everything, right? But in which we haven't recognized that it's the same God we're seeing everywhere. And so we're split among all these different aims and all these different sub-personalities, and we're sort of crazy, right? And so psychotherapy is trying to help us with all this craziness, right? So it tries to sort of like help us tame the critic and blah, 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 right? But really, what's health? Where are we going? And so I would suggest that the more closely the soul pervades the personality, and the more fully the soul shows up, the more psychological health there is. Because basically, the only faculty in us which is capable of resolving our absolutely irresolvable personal problems is the soul. Right? So this now provides psychology a context, right? So when I'm doing psychotherapy, I'm trying to feel for the soul. Right? What does the soul want? Right? And what will help the soul become more interesting? Because, you know, when people start living really crappy lives, the soul loses interest. I mean, many of you may have felt this. I've felt it. Right? I reached a point at one point in my life where I knew that my soul was going to give up. And that if I didn't leave a certain situation I was in, I was simply going to die because my soul would no longer tolerate it. It was really clear to me. And so, you know, so the question is, we have to start recognizing the soul as an entity that has a certain pressure and a certain presence in our lives. In general, it happens to be the case that people experience the soul behind the heart. There's some way in which the soul's presence seems to manifest there. Sri Aurobindo calls it the secret cave behind the heart, right? Which is both literally, oddly, in the heart, in the body, right? But also metaphorically, it's sort of behind the emotions. Because the soul, he says, shows up in us as our instinct for the true, the good, and the beautiful. Which nothing else can account for. Right? The intellect can't do that, and the emotions can't do that. The feeling for truth and beauty and goodness is beyond any of our finite faculties, right? And so it's an expression of the soul. And so to live a life turned over to the cultivation of soul presence, that's where you're going to live. And I think it would be the foundation for a very valuable school of psychotherapy.
Yeah, I really like that. I'm not clear on your stance on this. I'm coming from a history of evolutionary astrology that sees the soul choosing. I mean, generally, this is the view. There's some diversity on the evolution of the soul and choosing, you know, one's chart to master lessons. But it's kind of, for the most part, what I understand it's seen as an upward spiral, right? So
right.
Starting with, like, you know, more clear shadow struggle constellation and then moving upward, but then and I'm reading Chris do you pronounce his last name Baish?
Yeah.
Life cycles, and
yeah.
He actually says, you know, when you see somebody, it's sort of like the state you were describing, you're like, I'm gonna die if I don't get out of this situation, like really. And some people have said about me, like, wow, you really went for the karmic big time, like I've had a lot of serious struggle and trauma in my life, like to not necessarily like pity that path, that in his view and his research, that could be advanced souls that are like, you know, at sort of the end of, like, mm-hmm. they're approaching nirvana.
Sure.
So I just, which really kind of contradicts a lot of evolutionary astrologer views of, like, you know, the upward spiral getting, like, you're moving into
right.
The
well, the question, I tend to agree that the soul is evolving. And it is what does the evolving. I mean, when there are two, Sri Aurobindo says there are two parallel evolutions, an evolution of form and an evolution of soul. And the soul does evolve. However, I would agree that the ego's criteria cannot tell us about the advancement of the soul. So, for example, somebody like me, I think I said, might come back in my next lifetime as autistic. Because I didn't do enough heart work this lifetime and needed to, right? And that'd be more advanced, but I'd be stupid, right? Or maybe, you know, I'd have to come back in some really poor circumstance to learn humility, right? And so, in other words, it's not that the soul's it's not that the more evolved the soul is, the wealthier its person is, right? And the prettier the person is, right? The soul's got much more interesting things to work on. So I would agree the soul is evolving. And that it does evolve through every life, but that you can't tell from somebody's life circumstances the level of their soul evolution. It's much more subtle than that. Does that sort of agree with you?
Yeah, I'm just wrestling with, you know, you're talking about staying connected and authentic expression of soul as, like, you know, unification with this bliss motive, right? But if that's the case and you see somebody in, like, the midst of, you know, just a really wrenching life or a set of life circumstances, how does that fit with bliss?
Well, that is bliss. You see, we have to remember that bliss is not pleasure. Sri Aurobindo says that pleasure, pain, and indifference are three different inflections of bliss, right? So that's why I usually use the word value instead of bliss. Right? But this is what's fascinating. It's that, this goes back to what I was saying earlier.
my life and your lives, I bet, are confusing. We don't know what's going to happen in the future. We're all feeling some anxiety about what's going to happen in the future from time to time, right? And we don't know what the consequences of our actions are going to be. We don't know if the things that we do to be good are going to be helpful or harmful. We just don't know, right? This is a tremendous ignorance. And also, we crave a certain amount of alternation, right? So if somebody told you that from this moment forward, everything in your life would be pleasant, you might feel a little ambiguous about it, right? It's like, what would be the fun of that? It would get boring, right? And so there's a way in which, a profound way in which, we are here to experience this bewilderment. We're here for the pleasure of not knowing what's going to happen next, and for taking a chance, right? Playing with dice, as it were, right? We are God playing with dice about his own life, right? Which is like so. And so there's a way in which, and I know you all know this, we crave samsara. We're here because we want to be here. And it's not that we have fucked up egos that want to be here, but our souls are just waiting for us to wake up. No, our souls came here to enjoy this bizarre twilight state.
Right?
And I believe that because I can feel it in my heart. Right? I can feel it. You know, like one time I went to this play, and it was a play about Genesis, right? And at one point, so the Eve, the play Eve, comes out into the audience with the apple, offering it to people, right? I couldn't wait to take the first bite. It was like, you know, well then I remember reading Alice Bailey, and Alice Bailey is saying, you know, actually the solar system is much bigger than we think it is because many planets aren't in the physical world right now. They're in other parts of their cycle, and only a few planets are in the physical system. 27 or 28 planets, I forget all the numbers, right? She says, but I'll tell you this, she says, of all the places in the solar system, the worst is the Earth. The most slum of all the solar system. And I thought, that's where I want to go. And so, you know, it's like the soul craves these experiences, right? That's what I was trying to say before. Like, I know that I have reached a point of development where if my soul wanted to become enlightened, I can be like Sri Aurobindo. But it doesn't. I know it doesn't, right? My soul is really happy being a college professor and talking about these things, right? And sharing them with you and struggling toward them. But my soul's not willing to give up my bewilderment and my confusion and my anticipation and my lust and all that other kind of stuff that it enjoys so much.
But how do you explain when it becomes so much that you want to die?
But you don't. The question is, why don't you die? And the answer is because your soul's having too much fun. You see, why do people who are being tortured live so long, right? Because the soul finds bliss in everything. Because we're here for the adventure. We're not here for the pleasure. We're here for the adventure of the whole thing.
But some people can't take it.
And then they die. The soul says, okay, that's enough for this life.
What about those who impose pain on others?
That's fun too.
Yeah. Well.
Well, we can think of it as instead of bad experience versus good experience, it's experience at all versus
yeah.
no experience.
Finite experience.
You're souling up there and you can't even feel anything. You don't feel good, feel anything.
It's something like that.
But I think meaning comes from this division between good and evil. I think there's something more meaningful about doing good in the face of evil.
And drama, right? I mean, the battle of good and evil is the ultimate drama. I mean, how many plots of movies don't revolve around good and evil in some way, right? It's good drama. We love it, right? We fight wars because we love the drama. We love the heroic sacrifice, you know, the marching bands, right? The horror of observing people's guts strewn out on the ground and the extreme fragmentation and mental deficiency that comes for the rest of the life, right? Crawling around in the gutter as a heroin addict, right? The soul eats this stuff up, right? Otherwise it wouldn't happen, right? This is how the soul develops, right? And we all know it. You all know what I'm saying. You know you're here because you love it, right? Because you're not spending all your time meditating. You're not, you know, you're here because you're enjoying life. And the soul enjoys life, and that's why there's reincarnation, so we can keep on enjoying life as long as we're done.
You're just playing that part, aren't you? Mm-mm. You're just acting that out.
No, I actually believe that. It's actually what gives me spiritual souls. No, really. It really is. I know. I remember getting, this is way too personal, but I got in big trouble in undergraduate in a course on phenomenology. And we were talking about Heidegger was a Nazi. And maybe we shouldn't read him because he was a Nazi. Now, I might be a little more sympathetic to that now than I was then. But in those days, I wasn't at all sympathetic to it. I thought, I'll read him as a philosopher. I don't care what he did. But we got to talking about the whole thing. And I said, well, you know, all human beings are capable of anything that human beings can do. I said, I could easily have been mowing down Jews into mass graves in Poland in World War II, given different circumstances. And I probably could have gotten pleasure out of it. Right? Well, of course, people were a little nervous about me. Right? But I believe that. And because I believe that, I feel deep compassion. Right? I know that there is nothing about any human being, no matter how heinous, that is not also in me, because we're all in each other, right? I know that my particular personality has been struggling toward the light of spirit for a very long time, and so I tend to be a nice guy, right? But in the right circumstances, that might not happen. I don't know what I'm capable of, you know, given enough pressure from the outside. I just don't know.
But right. The problem with evil is that it like limits creativity and complexity. It's reductionistic.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
It's dissonant.
Exactly.
And that's why it's not. That's what makes it. I don't know if that's what makes it evil, but that's one of the problems. That's why the good is more enjoyable. Beautiful and more.
That's right. But God, in God's self, is more complex, more perfect, and more beautiful than anything else could possibly be. And yet God expresses these incredibly ugly universes. There's got to be bliss in it.
Well, I think I have a solution for it. But...
yeah, you know, I have to apologize. I mean, I'm being quite mythic. I mean, this is my
great.
Myth.
Okay. It's great.
Okay, but it's not something that I'm just... I'm not doing this for hype, and I'm not doing this for drama.
I thought you are doing it for drama. Which is it?
Well, I'm doing everything for drama. But the drama that I'm trying to enact right now is the drama of being serious. Over to you.
Thought maybe you all know things like this, but I was interested when I heard people who kind of connected with past lives, and often the past life they found out they had lived was something in total opposition to what they were living now. Mm-hmm. So an African-American woman had been a Dutch slave trader, and a woman who was very much interested in women's spirituality had been an inquisitor of witch trials.
Right.
And like this was really eye-opening to them and helped them in their soul evolution to realize exactly what you said, that we're all part all the good and the evil.
Exactly.
I just found that
striking. The thing about past life memories is, how many of you have had what you consider to be a past life memory?
Oh my God.
And they can be really vivid, right? And really transforming, right? But they're always psychologically relevant.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And so now, of course, they would have to be, and we couldn't remember them. But on the other hand, there's always something slightly suspicious about it. It's like, you know, I mean, especially, for example, there's some psychics, you know, and they'd meet me and say, oh, you were a great philosopher in ancient Greece. Bullshit, right? It's like, you know, come on, give me a break, right? And then there are some people who remember all these past lives in which they were Cleopatra and Genghis Khan. And then I think, well, come on, give me a break. Why are you who you are now, if that's the case, right? So obviously, past life memories are suspicious. When they happen, they can be immensely convincing. But that's all we get, that immense conviction. So I'm never quite sure how to handle them, but they sure are powerful when they happen, and in our theory, they should happen. So.
And also, but also in your theory, it invites us to reflect on the multiple possibilities that might be there. What is that? I have this profound phenomenon.
That's right. Experience. And what is it?
It feels like me, but maybe it's some other occasion, or there's a million things it could be.
Yeah, or maybe it's a fantasy.
Yeah.
Right?
It's a fantasy, a projection, or whatever.
Exactly. So I want to stay really open to those questions all the time. Yeah. But like I say, our theory makes reincarnation memories quite plausible. But our theory does not make hallucinations less probable, right? And delusions of various kinds. And so we still have the problem of discriminating a genuine, quote-unquote, past life memory from some dream that maybe was just as a fantasy, right? And so this is one of the crucial questions in all parapsychological and transphysical research, is trying to make these distinctions.
How much do you of past life memory think is culture bound? Because there's reports that children cross-culturally spontaneously describe past life memories, and in the West, parents get freaked out.
Yes.
Think they're psychotic and repress it.
That's
right. In the East, it's encouraged.
Yeah, it's happening more and more here now too.
It just happened to a friend of mine. I have a 4-year-old son describing they went someplace and he just. Oh yeah, I'm feeling really sad because, my friend died here, and it's just like a friend,
this
elaborate story came out, and I discussed it with her to cautiously maybe nurture that, despite the fact don't tell his teachers about it because I'll end up inpatient. But
you can give the teacher, there's some great books about this now that are very scientific and so forth. Jim Tucker wrote a great book, the name of which I've forgotten. But he's the person carrying on Ian's teaching. And Jim had his parents read that book. I forgot the name of it, something about past lives, but it's about children's past life memories. It's a very good book. Particularly, he's writing it for a popular audience, and it's exactly what would be helpful to them. I had something else to say. We're talking about past life memories, and I forgot where we're going. Sorry, my mind's kind of sibling right now. Last week, you guys should know this, it's a purely random fact. Last week, I had the worst major depression I had ever had. At one point, I thought I was going to have to go to the hospital. And it turned out it was an antibiotic reaction.
Wow.
Right? I mean, I was unable to move for days. I couldn't think. I'm still kind of spacey, Yeah, that stuff is powerful. You don't expect it from antibiotics. So if you take antibiotics and you get psychotic, think about the antibiotics. Man, that was an intense week.
Yeah, actually, it's funny you're mentioning that. We were talking about the liver and the cleansing and stuff. I was on serious parasitic medication last week, and I screamed at all these people on the bus.
Yeah.
Who I thought were going to kill me because it was crazy.
Yeah.
It was so not. Yeah, I was cursing and told people to get off the bus and how much I hated them and.
Oh, yeah.
Crazy. I think the bus driver wanted to kick me off.
Yeah. Well, see, this is another reason I think that personality can't be the real thing, because you take a pill, you have to take a different personality, right? So it's so conditional on circumstances. Right?
Mm. Yeah.
Mm. So I had something good to say, but well.
All these things say about reincarnation.
Good.
But I think it's curious when you asked about how the correlations of past life memories create with what was happening in the moment with someone, and that both times I've had past life experiences, it was actually when I was doing something that I thought someone in past life was doing. When I went to live in an ashram, I had this deep experience of being a some sort of holy man with people who needed me to touch their heads.
Yeah.
And do this, and then. A time before, I was going to go help at my friend's farm, and I had this experience of being like a farm worker in Africa, and I remember looking out and like seeing certain animals and having tools, and so it's really interesting. I've been trying to figure out if that means that I'm like following something that they did, and so I'm having a certain moment where it's like, oh, I did this before, I'm doing it now, like a deja vu, or if it's really like past life guiding me towards doing something. I don't know.
These are the kind of questions we need to do.
Yeah.
you know? Like, or is it some other farmer you're experiencing at that moment,
exactly.
Right? You know, it's like, how do we figure these things out, right? It's just, these are the interesting questions that are opening up for us.
Well, a question I have is, why don't I have more of your memories in me?
Well,
why doesn't that happen more often?
Well, because, A, we have different value characters. Hmm. B, we're not part of the same personality, and so memories tend to stay in the personality. We're finite beings living in a waking world, and we do have a lot of experiences like that we don't consciously attend to. Right. So I remember I was sitting with a buddy of mine. We had this 30-year argument about whether or not telepathy was real. And we were sitting in this restaurant having this argument, right? And my friend, by the way, happens to be that my friend is not a very sexual guy. It's just not a big part of his life. And it's a really big part of my life. So we're sitting there, and the waitress comes up, and she's middle-aged, you know, sort of frumpy looking. And she serves our food. And I'm thinking, I wonder what it would be like to be in bed with her, right? And my friend, who never talks that way, says, you know, I was just noticing that, but we like to sleep with her, right? He's in the middle of denying it there's any telepathy. He would never say this if I wasn't there. I had the thought and it came out of his mouth, right? So there's all this unconscious telepathy going on that if we start to pay attention to, we'll notice. It's very interesting.
I have a question. Just kind of going off of what you were saying a little bit. Sometimes I feel like there's experiences where they're really clear experiences and like you're looking down and you're like, I'm going to remember this. And like you kind of like are able to go back to those moments where you're like, wow. Totally remember being there and that,
yeah.
Just you were really embodying that present moment. Now if there's a, you know, a farmer in Africa and he's in the middle of tilling his farm and he just has that clarifying moment, he looks up and he's like, wow, I'm in a beautiful place and I'm really appreciative of this.
Right.
At that same time, is it possible that somebody in that same moment or in a similar situation can like tap into that experience and
yes.
Have that type of clarifying, like, wow, this is really amazing.
Yes.
And
absolutely.
So that could, you know, it might be tied
that's
to
right.
Reincarnation, or it could be just tied to somebody else experiencing a deep moment.
That's right. Absolutely. And that's brilliant. And you're really getting clear. It's perfect. And these are the kind of questions I would like to see if we can find ways to answer. Is it knowable, the difference between a past life memory and the experience of somebody else who's awake at the same time? How do we begin to make these discriminations? What do we have to do? Right? I don't know the answer. These are just the questions that we're being led into in this new era. And so these are the kind of scientific questions that will occupy us for the next centuries. So does anybody have any interesting ideas about what we might do with our last class next time?
Just meditate the whole time while we're all in like total samadhi.
That's an idea. Yeah? Anybody else have another idea?
I always thought it would be cool if we would actually try to practically apply some of this. But
yeah.
I think that's probably a much longer ongoing project. Like, try to get into those spaces and talk about how to do it and start practically.
I'm very interested in that. And
maybe we need help from someone who has more experience.
Well, you know, Natalie stopped coming, was very interested in helping us with that. And so we might be able to, she has some experience that's interesting, and we could probably pull together some kind of group maybe over the summer experiment. So that's interesting. So if you're really interested in that, let's keep talking about it. Maybe send me an email if that would be interesting to you.
That'd be cool.
Yeah. And So I think I had that on the syllabus. I would talk about transphysical technology, but that's really a very short thing to talk about. So I'm not sure. I'd like to do something with our time, but if anybody has any ideas, send me an email. Maybe we can do something, a little ceremony or something fun. I don't know exactly, but so if you have any ideas of what we might do to make our last class special, let me know. I'm not very good at those ideas, but I'm interested in them. So, and if not, we'll just review and have a discussion and just appreciate each other.
I would like to have a class review. It's pretty quick.
Okay, let's do that then. We'll do a review of the whole thing.
Just to create a context
that
can, a closure on the ideas.
That's a great idea.
You know what would be kind of fun would be to do that? Because here it all makes sense. And we go out in the world and someone challenges us. It's like, well, I thought I could explain it, but I have no idea. So, like, pose a question like, I don't believe any of this and that and that. How would you answer it? You know, we could try to answer it and then, like,
apologetics.
Oh, I see a lot of support for that. Okay. So now I'm not sure how to format that. Like, would we maybe do payers in the middle and just experiment?
Maybe I'll talk to my husband and see what he challenges me with.
Okay. I can imagine that in the first half of class I do a summary of the whole thing. And then in the second half we can play with arguments and rebuttals.
It's
kind of be fun.
That's a great idea.
All right, wonderful. Okay, thank you all so much.